From the ACLU, this is At Liberty. I'm Kendall Seismeyer, your host. On April 22nd, the Supreme Court will hear the case of Johnson versus Grants Pass. This will be the most significant court case about the rights of homeless people in decades. At its core, Grants Pass will decide whether cities are allowed to punish people for things like sleeping outside with a pillow or a blanket, even when there are no safe shelter options, posing potentially great risk to the 250,000 Americans who sleep outside on any given night. This case comes at a time when the affordable housing market is strapped, with a deficit of 6.8 million affordable housing units needed nationwide for extremely low-income families. What's more, according to a recent Harvard study, one in four renters, or 11.2 million households, are severely burdened by rents that take up over half of their incomes. These millions of renters living paycheck to paycheck are at significant risk of losing their home at the turn of a rainy day, with Americans of color, disabled Americans, and queer and trans Americans at even greater risk. With so many folks on a razor-thin edge of experiencing housing instability, all eyes are on Grants Pass. Joining us to talk a little bit more about the case and the broader systemic issue of housing instability, homelessness, and what it will take to make a meaningful dent in both is Jennifer Friedenbach, the executive director of the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco. Jennifer, welcome to At Liberty, and thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
So, Jennifer, I want to start with the case at hand, which is Johnson versus Grants Pass. It's going to be argued next week. We'll get a decision later this year in June. When you heard the case was headed to the Supreme Court, what were your first thoughts? Are you concerned?
Yeah, I was surprised. And then I was really worried because the Supreme Court didn't take this up the first time. But it's really, you know, it's such a political court. And since Fox News has been kind of using homelessness as a way to try to shame Democratic strongholds in major cities, that it has become so political. And so I think that's probably why they took it up.
Yeah, that makes sense. Usually they like to take up things that are kind of going on in the public discourse. A discussion in this case is whether or not people can sleep outside without punishment. Punishment being arrest or criminal charge. What does that look like as it exists today? What are city governments like currently allowed to do?
Yeah, so not all, first of all, not all city governments are following the law as it is, which is why there's so many lawsuits on this. They can still do operations in terms of removing encampments for health code violations. If someone's blocking a sidewalk, you know, I mean, all these different kinds of things. Really, it's a very narrow right, but a really important right. And that is that they can't cite or arrest people for lodging or like sleeping on the sidewalk if they haven't offered shelter first. And so that really kind of creates pressure on these municipalities to address the issue instead of just kind of pushing people around and violating their rights. So, you know, they're also not supposed to be taking people's property and throwing it away. And so there's protections that people enjoy that are, you know, at a point in their lives where they're really experiencing, you know, a devastating situation where they have lost their housing. And then, you know, to have the city governments kind of then stomp all over them, it feels like for homeless people to be kicked when you're down, frankly. And so these little rights at least create a little bit of protections for them against these actions.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think kicking you when you're down is such a good way of putting it. And we see this across so many disciplines of American public policy, so many different areas that we work on at the ACLU. But I want to dig in a little bit to encampments, because I think encampments have, with the pandemic and subsequent amplification of our housing crisis, grown to exist in many American cities beyond kind of historically where they existed in the American West, so to speak. And as you mentioned, they've become this sort of political hot potato. People are talking about encampments. And city officials are facing a lot of public pressure to increasingly break up encampments. What do you make of the public pressure? Why is this happening now? What do you want people to know about the kind of pressure that they're putting on city officials?
Yeah, I mean, folks are really frustrated, right? I mean, they're frustrated. There's, you know, a group of people who are completely destitute that don't have access to sanitation, hygiene, bathrooms, water, and folks are frustrated. Nobody's as frustrated, of course, as homeless people themselves who are experiencing, you know, this humanitarian crisis that is hurting them and taking years off their lives. And so, you know, but if people don't have anywhere to go, it doesn't solve the problem. And so a lot of times we have a situation with rising rents and this huge disparity between income and the cost of housing across the country, but really significant on the West, up and down the West Coast. And so when the governments come in and they say, okay, we're just going to move people, it hurts everybody because you're basically wasting resources that could be better spent on solutions. It also erodes trust in city government because you don't have a real response. You have this kind of performative, fake kind of use of force. But what it does do, what we do know it does is that it lengthens homelessness because when they take people's property, they lose their paperwork. They lose contact with social workers that are connecting them with social workers. People get fines and fees that they can't pay, court dates that they miss because they don't have an address to receive the notifications. They get warrants out for their arrests, creates this pauper's prison. In San Francisco, 40% of our jail population is unhoused. And then when people have warrants, they get kicked off of public housing wait lists. I mean, it's really something that creates this problem, and it erodes trust with unhoused people who oftentimes are coming out of foster care and other institutions where they already have a mistrust. So it really hurts everyone.
I mean, as you kind of described, encampments, breaking up encampments is happening very commonly by city officials, but it's not actually solving the problem. We like in America to put band-aids on issues instead of going to the root cause and trying to really do the hard work to fix the problem. What do you think is undergirding this lack of a meaningful solution? Is it a lack of political will or is it something else?
It's absolutely a lack of political will. And I think that derives from who is out there on the streets. I mean, it's incredibly destitute people who is a class of people that are still okay to hate. And so it's you know, very common for tropes to be put out there about this community that are fundamentally untrue. And they really kind of other people by saying that they're, you know, unhoused people in their city. Every city in the United States does it. Their homeless population came from elsewhere, when in fact, it's the majority of people became homeless as housed people in that particular city. And then, you know, you have tropes around, you know, substance use and people being addicts, when in fact, homelessness rarely is caused by addiction. Yet homelessness, once people are homeless for a long period of time, does increase rates of addiction because of the traumas associated with homelessness. And, you know, this whole idea that people are refusing services when nowhere in the United States do we have a system of care that is ready for this crisis and able to address these really deep socioeconomic disparities. So we have some huge inequities in the United States, and homelessness is the visual representation of that. And for me, that's really what brings me to the work is that you see this overrepresentation of oppressed communities. You see an overrepresentation of African Americans, overrepresentation of members of the LGBTQ community, overrepresentation of people with disabilities. And it's not just a little bit over. I mean, in San Francisco, African Americans are 5 times more likely to experience homelessness. It's very dramatic. You know, members of the queer community, 2 times as likely. So it really is where these intersections of oppression exist.
Thank you for laying that out there. You know, I think that some folks might be listening and think, wow, this is unusual for the ACLU to be involved in this issue, to be talking about homelessness as a social problem. But I think the intersectionality that you just described is exactly why we are involved. it is something that disproportionately is impacting communities that we fight for their rights, you know, like, so whether that's women, people of color, you know, you named a plethora of folks. I also think that what you said about it being a visual representation of those kind of societal problems that still exist, the hate that still exists. You also listed a number of stigmas and misconceptions about the population of people who experience homelessness. Why do you think we still have such a stigma attached to homelessness? And really, what do we do about it? How do we chip away at the stigma?
Yeah. You know, I think part of it is kind of political constructs. I mean, what we've managed to do is make racism, homophobia, ageism, disablism, for the most part, you know, kind of unacceptable, right? I mean, it's not that it doesn't exist anymore, but there's
a social pariah factor to it. Like,
exactly.
If you're overtly those things, people are going to make note.
Right. And so on this issue, disdain for unhoused community members really cloaks that underlying racism, homophobia, ageism, disablism. And so it creates a scapegoat for policymakers that can go unchecked. And then those misconceptions end up kind of permeating the mindset. And when you have also a response that really erodes public trust in a solution, people's level of frustration gets higher and higher. And they get to this point where there's nothing going to be done. I'm just okay with anything. Just get them out of here. And so, you know, I think that's a huge piece of it. And I think, you know, and it's pretty deep at this point. Like, it's, you know, they do these scientific studies where, you know, what kind of has like an emotional reaction for people, and homelessness is, you know, it creates a disgust in folks. And so how we overcome it, I think, is the same way we overcome these other issues, is that we really humanize the issue and make sure that the voices of folks who are personally impacted by homelessness are elevated and are centered in our discussion. So, you know, we really need to be consistent in that. And that's a big part of what the Coalition on Homelessness does locally.
I want to focus in on San Francisco for a second. So I'll start with the case at hand, because the Grants Pass case coincides or is addressing something that another case that the ACLU of Northern California and the Coalition on Homelessness are a part of. The Coalition on Homelessness is a plaintiff in a lawsuit against the city of San Francisco. What can you tell me about that case, how it relates to the Grants Pass case, and why you all filed this lawsuit with the ACLU of Northern California?
Yeah, definitely. So for years, we were trying to work with the city to establish policies so that we have a humane and effective, you know, so that actually leads, which is also humane, to getting people off the streets, you know, on their street response. And we got some pretty decent policies in place around bagging and tagging, you know, in a process for if you're taking homeless people's property because they're not there, you know, you bag and tag it, leave a notice, and they have a certain amount of time to come and pick it up. That we have a process for leading with services and trying to get people into, you know, off the streets and into shelter housing, et cetera. However, the city was not following those policies. And we basically had, you know, collected all this evidence. I mean, a mountain of evidence, honestly. We found that over 3,000 cases of the city citing or arresting people without having offering shelter first, massive amounts of property destruction. And what happened was that once we filed, because the city was not able to come back and correct, you know, and challenge any of that evidence, because it was all true, a judge ended up, you know, issuing an injunction against the city that basically said that the city had to follow the law. And so one of the things that we found in this process is that the city designed forms to evade responsibility for not having enough shelter beds by having this binary choice of either homeless people accepted shelter or they refused shelter. And that's what they clicked on their forms. But at every encampment, when we gathered the evidence, they would say an encampment of 10 people and they only had 3 shelter beds to offer. And then we had public officials coming forward and saying that was a lie, et cetera. And so that they were forced to do these things. Not only, you know, are people not off the streets and are just kind of moved and trust is disintegrated, but, you know, like I was at an operation not too long ago where there was an African-American man that was there that was in a wheelchair. He really wanted to get off the streets. He was elderly. He needed to get off the streets. They swoop in with this use of force. They offered him an upper bunk and a shelter. Of course, he couldn't use that. And then they disappear. And then that guy is left out on the streets. So the neighbors who's complaining about that guy being there don't have their issues resolved. He doesn't have his issues resolved. And we just spent a ton of money on something that got us nowhere.
Oh, wow. I can feel the frustration in your voice when you talk about this. And it makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense because that example right there, I mean, it speaks to so much. It seems like a lot of government inefficiency, which I think pretty much everyone can kind of buy into. How do you make the government more efficient? How do you make local government, state government work for you on these kinds of issues? You know, so this case is going on at the same time as the Grants Pass case. The city has actually used the Grants Pass case to try to block the lawsuit. What is the interconnectedness between this national case, Grants Pass, the decision that we'll hear in June, and how it will impact the case with the city of San Francisco?
Yeah, in our lawsuit, we have 13 different claims, but this particular one around cruel and unusual punishment is one of them. This idea that if folks have no other choice but to be homeless, then the municipality shouldn't be able to cite and arrest them. And so that is one of our claims that the city is violating, and that is what's up in front of the Supreme Court. And so if they decide to overturn it, what it means is that basically the municipalities are free to cite and arrest people who have no other choice but to be on the streets. Yeah, and that doesn't totally kill our lawsuit, but obviously has an impact on one of our claims. And I feel like This particular right creates a pressure on the city. You know, this idea that they have to provide at least some modicum of services for folks, that if it disappears, is really a problem. And, you know, and of course, the whole idea of cruel and unusual, you know, who knows what the Supreme Court will do, but there's a lot at stake for everybody who's kind of protected around cruel and unusual punishment, for not being punished for who they are. And so, it's like many of these things, it really has a broad effect on everyone's, civil rights.
And conversely, if the Supreme Court were to decide it is cruel and unusual punishment to punish folks who are sleeping outside because they have no other place to go, that I imagine would strengthen the case that you all have existing against the city of San Francisco. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. This is for us is kind of like almost like a crowbar. You know, lawsuits take a lot of time, but what it does is oftentimes is that it forces the city to address things that they're unwilling to address. And, you know, our vision for this lawsuit is not just about these particular rights, but it's about getting the city to do the things that they need to do to holistically address the problem. So starting with an effective street response that's based on national standards that were established during the Obama administration, who recognized that criminalization is counterproductive. And so, you know, we have done it right in San Francisco. You know, we have this one model we refer to as the King Street model. It was a large encampment of folks that had some pretty severe acuities and barriers. And by working together with them and the city and with us and different folks, you know, they were able to have their voice at the table around what was going to address their needs.
I want to pick up on one thread that I think we've been alluding to a lot in this conversation, and we've even addressed like the potential impacts of criminalizing homelessness. But the idea of criminalization opening up this kind of broader authority for a police force to potentially even enact brutality. You know, I think that we've seen a lot in the past number of years. Police brutality has become a very notable and seen and spoken about issue, which is great. How does the increase of criminalization of homeless folks interplay with police authority or the ability for police to use force that would then yield really dire circumstances or impacts?
Yeah. The big picture is that this mass episode of homelessness is our second big mass homelessness in the United States since the Great Depression. And it's extended for decades and decades because we didn't do the things that needed to be done. In fact, we went in the opposite direction and cut our housing by 76% at the federal level. And so what's happened is that then this huge humanitarian crisis is kind of laid at the feet of municipal government. Municipal government has then used police as a primary response to homelessness. So if I'm, you know, if there's an unhoused person out in front of my home, whether I'm concerned about them and want to get them help or I want them gone, if I call the city, they're going to send out a police officer. It's about 15% of police calls. So because we have a large number of police officers responding to homelessness, and so just homeless complaints again alone are between 70 and 90,000 per year in San Francisco, this creates obviously a huge problem in terms of the opportunity for officer-involved use of force and officer-involved fatalities. In San Francisco, almost all of our officer-involved fatalities, along with even shootings, have been of, large portion is people with mental illnesses, large portion is African-Americans, and they intersect around housing status. Almost every single one of our officer-involved shootings have been of somebody who's out on the streets. So it really, again, kind of amplifies these inequities that people face. And, you know, we also have a lot of situations around illegal searches and seizures and, a lot more arrests around drug arrests and possession and all these other things that happen because there's just this constant interface with police for folks who are out on the streets because they don't have that protection of a door. They don't have their own home. And so basically everything is all kind of out in the open.
So much of this seems like we see various situations play out where we end up spending money kind of down the road to deal with the aftermath of a bad situation, as opposed to investing money kind of closer to before a bad situation happens, before someone is experiencing homelessness, before the police are called, before addiction happens, before all of these things that can kind of play out in this path. I'm curious, what are you at the Coalition on Homelessness advocating for currently that, you know, really seeks to address the root causes of homelessness?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. It literally costs more to keep people homeless than it would to just put them in housing. Most of those costs are around medical care. Yeah, it's really important for folks to know. Also police and, you know, other things, sanitation, et cetera. But the primary is the healthcare costs. Homeless people present as 25 years older their calendar year. So me as a 50-year-old woman, I'm 57, but let's pretend I'm 50, would present medically as a 75-year-old in terms of increased risk of like diabetes rates, heart disease, you know, all the things that go along with that responsiveness. And so it really wreaks havoc. So what we're doing at the Coalition on Homelessness, I mean, we really follow national best standards in terms of what we advocate for. And you really, every community can follow the same, and many communities across the country are doing this really well and having a lot of success. But you want to right size your system. You know, as we talk to unhoused folks, and what, you know, one of the first things they say, like in terms of what you want us to work on, is really would have been great if I could have been prevented from being homeless in the first place. A lot of times it's just a short-term subsidy. You know, maybe they're doing pickup labor and broke their arm and couldn't pay rent. Maybe it's a more catastrophic health issue or a longer-term subsidy through a struggle with cancer would have kept them in their housing, or maybe they're on a fixed income and they have a disability, or they're a senior and their rent's rising up above their income and a little subsidy for the rest of their life would have kept them in housing. But, you know, we really need to prevent people from becoming homeless in the first place. And then if they do become homeless and we don't prevent it, then we have shelter so that they don't end up on the streets. Shelter is not appropriate for everyone, but is appropriate for, you know, some folks. And they get in, and then that negative consequences of the streets doesn't affect them. But we want them to move out of shelter as quickly as possible. You don't want people stuck in shelter. And then you do that by having housing. And you have housing that's affordable to them. And we don't have to build all that housing. That's not necessary. We should build housing, of course. We should fully utilize all our public housing stock. But we can also acquire buildings. We can take tourist hotels and convert them into housing. We can also do subsidies in the private market, where we can have support services if the person needs the extra support services with those subsidies in the private market. So, you know, in San Francisco, for example, we got, you know, some matching money from the state, and we had an initiative that we put on the ballot. That's called Prop C, and we were able to, in a really short period of time, get about 1,000 units. And then we got also almost 1,994 or something, what people usually think about as Section 8s, but they now call them housing choice vouchers from the federal government. We were able to use all of those and get all of those folks in housing in San Francisco at our rental prices. So there's so much that can happen that we can do to address this issue. And it is going to save us money and save us resources, but we have to prioritize investments at the local, at the state, and the federal level. You know, everybody's, you know, in San Francisco, we spend, including all the money we get from the state and the feds and our local money, our budget for homelessness, to solve homelessness, is only 5.5% of our total city budget. That is not enough. That is not nearly enough, given it's a number one issue in San Francisco and in cities across the country.
Yeah, wow. I mean, Jennifer, I think that you sit in the kind of hotbed of this issue in a lot of ways. I think nationally speaking, San Francisco is one of the cities that is dealing more with this kind of rise in homelessness, though it's always existed. But I think especially being exacerbated by the cost of housing in the area, thanks to kind of the tech boom, the runaway cost of housing has impacted. I mean, folks that are not experiencing homelessness talk about this all the time when they're thinking about what cities to move to. So there's definitely a reputation there. So this issue, I wanted to actually bring this up to you because I do think that we see the use of homeless people as a political wedge, not just in San Francisco, certainly there, but more broadly. One of the things that always strikes me as curious is that even kind of quote-unquote well-meaning liberal folks will turn their backs on homeless people. There's a name for this. I think people colloquially call these folks NIMBYs, or not in my backyard folks, alluding to the idea that once this issue impacts these people, right, the people that are well-meaning liberal folks, and that affordable housing is going up in their neighborhood, they protest, they fight back. Why do you think this issue turns even the well-meaning liberal folks away?
You know, it's a really good question. And I think it kind of goes back to that intersectionality and the use of people as political scapegoats and kind of really kind of bringing up the fear. You know, folks oftentimes, you know, for unhoused people, it's so traumatizing to be on the streets, and their worst moments are witnessed by everybody else. You get in an argument with your partner, everybody's there to listen in. You know, all these private moments are public, I think, creating this situation where, you know, basically we're creating a permanent underclass in the United States. It is really disheartening because people do feel comfortable in these forums really saying very hateful things about an entire class of people that is completely unwarranted.
Yeah. I mean, I think we talk about this a lot on the podcast, whether it's in regards to anti-trans bans that are popping up across the country, education censorship efforts that are popping up in community meetings and school board meetings all across the country, folks who feel fervently and are fueled by typically fear, which, you know, then kind of after fear becomes hate, show up. They show up in numbers and they show their emotion. And sometimes they're the loudest voice in the room. And I think oftentimes folks who don't feel that way don't show up because they don't feel perhaps as passionate about it. What can you tell folks who are listening today and they want to do something in their local communities? What can you tell them about a good first step?
Yeah. First thing is homelessness is absolutely solvable and we all got to feel that in our heart. And I think this idea that it's unsolvable is working against us and that's just not true. You know, this is something we created by a host of really bad decisions. So folks should, first of all, get to know your unhoused neighbors just as you hopefully are getting to know your housed neighbors in the same way. Introduce yourself. There's a lot of individual support people can give. Be aware of those common tropes. Be active in your local neighborhood groups. And when they're coming up and they want to solve homelessness and this whole idea of we need the city to come in and call the police, push back on that and organize against it. Bring in some friends. Get a more positive direction because that energy that's pushing for a negative response can be shifted towards a positive response that actually solves it. And people need to be educated that, you know, a criminalization approach doesn't work. Get to know what services are in your area. And of course, make sure you're putting pressure on all your local, state, and federal electeds. You know, it needs to be a top priority for them. And it needs to be a top priority for our state reps. And it needs to be a top priority for the people doing the local government. And as we keep people homeless for longer and longer, it's more and more expensive to solve it. So we need to do the work to make all these corrections. And once we do, and folks are stable, we really can see an end to homelessness in this country.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Jennifer. This was such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for all the work that you're doing. It's really just so awesome. And we're so grateful that we have you fighting the good fight.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to At Liberty wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review the show. We really appreciate the feedback. Until next week, stay strong. At Liberty is a production of the ACLU, produced by me, Kendall Seesmeyer, and Vanessa Handy. This episode was edited by the good folks at Ultraviolet Audio. Genesis McPio is our intern.